From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the September 2019 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Veterans Reunion. On the 80th anniversary of the outbreak of World War II, we welcome 87 veterans back to Bletchley Park to meet each other, to reminisce and tell stories of their time here. As always, we bring you a flavour of the day and some of the many stories that the veterans shared with us.
These are today's main events. Germany has invaded Poland and has bombed many towns. General mobilisation has been ordered in Britain and France. Parliament was summoned for 6 o'clock this evening. Orders completing the mobilisation of the Navy, Army and Air Force were signed by the King at a meeting this afternoon of the Privy Council.
Stop me saying anything too stupid.
You've never said anything stupid yet, Mum.
Oh, thank you, Tony. Sorry, it's more my children coming
that's
in.
That's all right.
Christine Brose.
Christine?
Yes.
I think you've got a record today for travelling the longest distance to come to our reunion.
From Tasmania. Yes.
And have you come just specially for today, or are you on a long visit?
No, for today and see my friends and relations here.
Did you come from Australia originally?
No.
How did you end up in Australia?
Seeing the world after the war, and travelling around various places and married an Australian and stayed there.
Who have you got with you today? You've got at least one son. Is it two sons?
Two sons. This is a cousin and another cousin. An awful lot of us three.
Now, during World War II, you were at Bletchley Park.
Yes.
Now, where did you work at Bletchley?
Hut 8.
Now, before we sat down to do this, you said to me, I didn't do anything very important.
No.
But you worked in Hut 8, which was one of the most important huts.
Yeah.
What were the names of some of those unimportant people you worked with?
I really only remember first names until I meet them. Hugh, Sylvia and those sort of things, you know.
What about people like Hugh Alexander?
Oh, yes, I knew him.
This is what I mean. You were all so modest about what you did.
Yeah. No, well, he was there. He was our boss. Yeah.
I think you've got a story about him and someone else visiting one day? Churchill?
Well, I wasn't acquainted with Churchill. He maybe touched me, I don't think he did, maybe leaned over behind me and said something about I was doing all numbers and numbers and numbers at that point, and he said something which sounded extraordinarily stupid about where was the German or where was the text or something. And Hugh Alexander, I think, behind me, said something again, I thought rather short, that this was to do with the computing part, you know. And anyway, they moved on and I giggled.
How old were you then?
Oh, I'd have been 18, I suppose.
Did
18,
you come
19.
Here, did you come here at 18 then?
I came at 17 because they didn't take you in the army until you were 18. Yeah. And I left school and came here at 17.
Mm. And what year was that?
41.
So very early, weren't you?
Yeah.
You basically joined up as soon as you could, didn't you? Like you wanted to do your bit as soon as you could.
Yes. Mm. Mm.
Is that what you felt at the time?
Well, no, a thing to do. My brother was in the army and, I must do something, you know?
That's what I hear from so many veterans.
Yeah.
You know, their dad had been in the Great War, or they got a brother who was serving. And
no, never any question that I shouldn't do something.
Mm.
And so as soon as I was 17, whoops, I was off. Mm.
And were you Foreign Office staff?
Yes, I suppose I was. I had an interview in London Room 46 was spies and room 47 was us, I think. Went up there and ticket to Bletchley, 2 weeks close, and somebody will meet you at the station. That was it.
Did you have any idea what you'd be doing when you came here?
No, absolutely none.
Was it just sold to you as a clerical job or something?
Yes, that sort of thing. I mean, I could just type, but I'm not a cleric trained, no.
And how long after you got here did you realise, oh, this is something a bit special, isn't it?
I never did, I don't think.
Did you not? Well, you knew it was code-breaking, I guess.
No, not at all.
Really?
I arrived, and an Air Force chap met me at the station.
Mm.
He was driving there, drove me up, dumped me the door, went up and saw Travis or whoever it was in charge then. Mm-hmm. Signed the Official Secrets Act, told to go to Hut 8, and started straight off. Given a sheet of paper with four-letter words, you know, they're not what you call groups on them, and this is a German message, and I said, well, I don't speak German, you know, anyway, that was all right. And then I had to do a Banbury, we were on Banbury. Yeah, so I showed how to push a ruler along and mark off all the notes. And then the next thing is you go and punch holes. Then you had your sheet of holes. And then about the second day or so, you advanced and you did comparisons. And you slid your Banbury one on top of the other. 13 letters one way, 13 letters the other way. And, well, counting how many holes met. But we had lots of groups of three, and you wrote it down on another bit of paper. And if you met a group of six or seven, it was terrific. And a great deal of, they got very excited and shot that straight through to the crib room to be turned into German or whatever. And that was it. I did that for, well, a year and a half, solidly. And then there were other things they put on, other isthmuses and things we did. You only had to be reasonably tidy and reasonably good at adding and subtracting. I never did anything more difficult than that, you know.
Well, you say that. You say I didn't do anything more difficult than that. I don't think you quite realise how important the job that you were doing was.
Oh, yes, I do, and I can see why they needed to invent a computer.
You're one of the few people left that did that sort of work.
Yes, but, 12 or 16 girls, reasonably sensible and tidy, could do all this paperwork, but, of course, had to invent a computer where you could do it. Pressing them, yeah.
And so did you stay in the physical Hut 8 the whole time you were here?
In physical or in
it? Actually in Hut 8 the whole time, or did you move around?
I moved around in other parts of Hut 8, and I was keen to learn everything. So whenever we had anything like a pinch, you know, or pinches, you've got a day where there wasn't any work, I was the first to want to go work in another section.
And they let you do that?
Oh, yes.
Oh, really?
Well, after all, Hut 8 was the top of the private things. Yeah,
because a lot of the people we get to interview now, you know, they had quite boring jobs at Bletchley. You were in with the special crowd.
Well, I loved seeing what else. I did some Italian things on Italian. You wound a little handle and lots of paper to throw away. I don't remember what we were doing about it, but doing that. And I worked with Alan Ross. I haven't inquired if Ned is long dead now.
Probably, Ross, I would think so.
He had a section. He rather wanted me to go and be with him permanently. And when I asked Alexander, he said, don't know how you've got the face to ask. Aren't you happy? You know, okay. Shut up about it. I was much happier in Hut 8 than whatever he was doing, sorting them or something of that sort.
What was it like working for Hugh Alexander?
Oh, very nice. I can't think of working for anybody else. No, he wasn't angry. I do remember once I was doing something a bit special, doing an adding thing, you know, because I was fairly quick and tidy. And he came round with his girlfriend, an American woman. I don't know who she was, but she was somewhere attached there. And he was sort of showing her around there, I don't know how or why, and leaned over the back of me and she said, this gal can't even add up. And so then I showed it to Hugh, and he said, no, it's perfectly right, you keep on going. You think you had to add two easy letters and subtract another, you see. So she sort of say 8 and 7 doesn't make 9 or something, you know. And of course it did the way we had to do it. And it's quite all right. How long would you take you to Fiji? I was stupid enough to say it's about 3 hours. I was doing it all next day. I felt he was quite pleased the way I was doing it. That was something to help him make the bomb things go right. Yeah. And I thought it was funny. This girl can't even ride up. Interfering else up.
When you look back on what you did, are you proud of what you did?
Not a matter of being proud. I was happy. Yeah, no, I wasn't particularly. I'd probably be more proud to be running around in the front line or nursing or something, but it didn't come my way.
But it was as important what you were doing.
Oh, yes, I knew it was important. Oh, I loved it.
Because you should be proud. You should be very proud of
well,
what you
they did. Were very, very good in Hut 8, I don't know about everybody else, of telling us our results, which made all the difference. Because I remember after the Americans came in, the fella came down, apparently the girls over there, they're trying to have one, they're telling you they're counting potatoes in Idaho or something. Well, heavens, when you're killing German left, right and centre, make counting potatoes is rather dull.
It's interesting that you say that you were told what happened, because not many people were.
No, I think perhaps that was Alexander, I don't know.
I think so. I think probably because you were in Hut 8 as well, because I know I've interviewed people who worked in Hut 6.
Yeah.
And for ages they didn't know what was happening, but then they started being told regularly.
Yeah, yes. Well, as far as I knew, I always knew what was happening. But when we got good results, shut up and it's submarine gone, you know, that kind of thing, they told us, yeah.
We've done episodes on pinches and breaks. And I've actually interviewed one of the chaps who was in the boarding party in HMS Bulldog and boarded the U-110.
Oh, yes, a pinch.
Yes. Would you see that material when it came in?
Yeah. No, because it went into another room. They weren't going to waste time showing it to me, you know.
No, well, that's interesting to know that as well, you see.
No, well, that sort of junk went further down the passage. I didn't actually see it. We'd heard it had been done, of course, you know, because it
that's what
gave
I was
us
ask.
A day off, or not a day off.
Well, I was going to say, did it? You know, was there a different atmosphere in the hut when you knew someone's coming
delighted.
In?
And that's when we had a pinch or something good like that, was when we'd have less work to do. But, of course, they couldn't send us all home, because otherwise it got straight to Germany that we'd all been sent home, you know. So it was great, yeah.
And so when did you leave Bletchley?
Soon after the war, yes.
So you didn't stay on during the Japanese?
No, I didn't. Got sent to, I suggested various places you could do was the Fannies, because you know, they thought people could do clothes.
Oh, yeah.
But having been brought up in Bletchley, where they were rather free and easy, I didn't fancy those Fannies. That frightfully snobby for all. I mean, I didn't mind about class differences, but though we had none of that here. But everything Fanny was better than all these other ATS.
You won't get an ATS girl say that.
No, I know, but you would Fanny them. And that was in the training college for 3-4 weeks. So I decided it wasn't for me, and they decided I wasn't for them, thank goodness. So I could do their codes and things standing on my head. That was all right, but not there.
And then you moved over to Australia?
More or less. Well, no, not I do. I did a bit of other odd things, and then I went to Australia. Well, on my way of travelling, and I stopped in Australia.
And didn't go anywhere else. Yeah. Once you got there, that was it.
That's what I think, yes.
Your two sons are here today.
Two sons?
How proud are you of her? Do you realise how important the work she did was? It wasn't just she was here, she was working in one of the most important departments in the entire establishment.
Well, quite emotional day for us. Yes.
I could see that's.
Yeah, I never talked about it at home. My husband's German, actually. He was fighting on the other side. Actually, here once it was in Scotland with David, and there was a local dance anyway, and the Canadian sat down and said it was my husband in the war, and I said yes, but he was on the other side. What, you better one of them crouch? David was furious having his father called one of them crouch, you know. I just thought it was terribly funny. The poor Canadian was so embarrassed after. Well, Australia doesn't matter a bit.
No, but that's the nice thing. It's the fact we went through that war.
Yeah.
And really, at the end of the day, it was just a group of young men, British young men or Canadians or American or Aussies or Germans.
Yeah.
They're all just young men who had to fight.
Yeah.
And after it was done, we could all make up.
Mm. Well, not only the poor men, it's the husbands. I keep on getting Miss Shoe and Dolly Mix. Anyway.
What a pity.
This lady's husband was chased out of Poland or somewhere,
yeah,
wasn't he?
That's right, yeah.
When he was a baby.
Right.
And, you know, all nice people. It just happened. That was the way the cookie crumbles.
It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you today.
Well, thank you.
And I hope,
don't know what I've said there.
And I hope you realise just how important the work you did was, because
yes,
it was.
I didn't do realise all that now, but it was all fun to me then. I mean, not fun, you know, but life, yeah.
That's lovely to hear. And can I just say one last thing? Can I say thank you for your service?
Thank you. Oh, thank you very much. What can I say for that? Don't mention it. All these people are much more important.
You were telling that boat thing that you found out yesterday, the two ships which went and docked in...
Well, that was a mismatch. I didn't put this on there.
Okay, we're almost ready.
We're ready for our close-up.
I know, come on. Okay, can everyone look in here, please? Nowhere else, all up here. Okay, that's perfect. Now, everyone smile, please. Let's have a look. Oh, it's rather good. Hang on, another one. One more. And then last one. There we go. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Just before everyone moves.
Hang on.
Just before everyone moves, can I just say, on behalf of Bletchley Park, how proud and honoured we are to have all our veterans with us today. Can I just ask everyone to give us three cheers for the veterans, to say thank you for their service and for keeping that secret for all those years. Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Arthur Maddox.
And where did you work?
In Major Testa's section.
Okay, how were you drafted? Or did you just join up?
Rather by accident, I would say. I was recruited when I was a student at Oxford in 1942, but I'd already enlisted in the Army, and I was doing part-time training in the Armoured Corps, and the Armoured Corps managed to call me up before Bletchley could. But a couple of years later, in 1944, the Armoured Corps had got too many young officers and were only too happy to get rid of me into Bletchley. So I arrived at Bletchley only in August of 44.
Wow. So who came and got you from Bletchley, or was it something that happened organically?
I think somebody at Oxford University must have calculated that if I could make some sort of sense of economic theory, perhaps I could make a bit of sense of German ciphers. And so made some sort of recommendation to Bletchley that they might at least look at me as a possible recruit.
So somebody actually put you forward, you think?
Yes, because there was a whole mechanism in those days of drafting people in from Oxford and Cambridge.
As you look back now, today it's the 80th anniversary of the Polish invasion. How do you feel now? Do you feel proud of the life you've had and the work you did?
Yes, I do, because I was never particularly well suited to be a tank officer. I was totally unmechanical and hopeless at that. But I was very academic, and the work we were doing in the German ciphers was very much an academic sort of job, requiring pencil and paper and careful attention to detail and what was there in writing. I was only here from August 44 until May 45, when the German war came to an end.
And what was it like being here when the war ended? What was it like? Do you remember the day? Do you remember the time of day? Were you here on site when the war ended?
Yes, I was. It was fairly well expected, of course, by that time. In fact, we'd been almost anticipating it 6 months before, in September, October, when the effort to take the bridge at Anheim failed.
So no big party or anything afterwards?
I don't remember a party, no. Very disappointing, really.
So how old were you when you...
I was 22.
When you first came here, and yes. How old were you when you said 23?
Well, I was just about to have my 23rd birthday, yeah.
Okay. So just over a year, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you think that small part of your life changed you? Did it make you a different person, do you think?
The main change is that just at the time I came to Bletchley, I happened to meet the lady that I married. We stayed married for 72 years, so that was quite a change.
Wow. Yes. So did you meet her here, or was it
No. I met her through Bletchley because she was a girlfriend of one of my colleagues as we went through the training at Bedford for Bletchley. Because I started out by a couple of months being taught about ciphers at a school in Bedford, you see. And Bill was one of my colleagues there. And he introduced me to the lucky lady who married me.
And stole her away.
Yes, of course. And Bletchley had the further good sense of transferring him to Italy.
Ah, so, right. So, no competition.
I'm glad to say he found some other lady to marry, and you know, I think he was 5 children.
Wow. So, apart from finding the love of your life on the course before you came to Bletchley, was it mainly men, or was it mixed?
Yes, it was entirely men. And it was a very well-organized course. We were simply given a textbook written by John Tiltman, the chief cryptographer, and we were set exercises, and we had to work our way through all these exercises. And it was a very, very cleverly drafted textbook. We were left entirely on our own. Occasionally, a so-called instructor might pop in to make sure we hadn't gone totally crazy. And if we were about to go crazy, then you might give us a kind of half a hint. Uh-huh. And that was a very good technique, because when you're tackling a cipher, you're really entirely on your own. You're like Bill Toot looking at the wall and simply trying different ideas as they come up. It's entirely up to you to have ideas that may or may not work out.
So it's like an interpretation,
yes,
almost.
Yes, yes.
I suppose in some cases you could liken it to a different language,
yes,
learning,
yes, yes,
and through that and going forward.
Yes, yeah.
And while you're using it, it keeps it fresh in your brain.
Yes,
I suppose,
yes.
Once you stop, you'll lose the effect of it.
Yeah.
So, how have you enjoyed today being here at Bletchley?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Well, everybody makes such a fuss of me, so I've done nothing but win the war.
So you've had the full rock star treatment.
I certainly have, yes.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
It is stated in London on the highest authority that if the proclamation of Herr Hitler should mean, as it would seem to mean, that Germany has declared war on Poland, Great Britain and France are inflexibly determined to fulfill to their uttermost their obligations to the Polish government.
I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. I'm living in a kind of...
I'm sat here with Audrey Hodges, and Audrey was a member of the Foreign Office staff who worked at Bletchley Park during the war. And I see, Audrey, that your original name was Cato. Now, does that mean you've got Roman heritage in you?
I think it must be, because I've got a Roman nose.
Now, what did you do at Bletchley Park during the war?
What did I do? I did typing, codings on the typewriter. You had to be very quick and fast. Mm. I didn't know where it went or anything like that, because you never told anything.
No.
So, you know, it was just a job that I was doing for my country, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're sat here today, and today's the 80th anniversary of World War II starting.
Yeah.
And did you join up?
No. I'll tell you what happened. I came out of college because I'm a very fast typist, but getting a job was difficult, but I got one in a furniture shop for a little while, and then the furniture shop closed down, but then they put me in a factory where they made tops and dyes. Of course, you had to put your hands in all the... I was no good at it, but I used to break the concrete.
And was this during the war?
This was during the war, and it was a small company, and the lady in the office took ill, and they called me. I mean, I expected, knew I had experience of office work, so they called me and said, would I take over? So I took over. When she came back, I thought, I'm not going back in the factory again. Because you were put there, you see, whether you liked it or not. And I thought, no, I'm not going back again. So then I went to the labour exchange, and I thought, right, I'm not going back. What are you going to do about it? And they said, would you go down to London? So I said, yeah, I'd have a go. Would you go to the Thorn office? So I said, yeah. So I came down, had the interview.
So where did you come from originally?
I come from Newcastle-on-Tyne.
So when they said Foreign Office to you,
yeah,
did you think they want me to be a spy?
No, I didn't. I just accepted it.
And what happened when you got to London?
So when I got to London, they said, oh, have you got any bag of clothes or anything? So I said, no, but I said, she said, oh, you'll have to go back and get them. So we got a bag, and my parents didn't come with me. I just came down on my own. They didn't tell me where I was going or anything like that. And all of a sudden, they put me in this van with soldiers and took me here.
Really?
Yeah.
So if they told you what...
They didn't tell me a thing.
So when you got here, I guess you went through the usual process of our
veterans. Indeed.
And did you sign the Official Secrets Act the first
day? Oh, yeah.
Was that when you realised this is a bit different to just a normal office job?
I suppose it was, yeah. I just thought to myself, well, I'm doing the same as my family are doing. One was in the army, and I'm, you know, protecting my own country, really.
A lot of the veterans I speak to, especially the ladies, they'll all speak about either their father being in the First War, or their brothers, or their fiancés being in the Second World War. And you did feel like you were doing your bit.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, because our two sisters were in the Land Army, and, you know, and the whole family was doing something, really. I just sort of accepted it. And then they put me in this digs.
Do you remember where they were?
Somewhere near Bedford.
That far away?
Yeah.
So did you have to get a bus every day?
No, the army used to come and collect me and bring me,
You got special treatment. So did you have to share a truck with soldiers every day then?
Yeah. Yeah, there and back. Used to come and collect me, and of course, night you're on shift sometimes. Yeah. And I was afraid of the dark. He used to say, we had to go along this alleyway, and I used to see the soldier, take me along there, will you, to the house.
People forget the blackout. I mean, I've walked around here at night, and because it's not lit, there's no street lights on the park. It does kind of give you the impression of what it would have been like, you know, just out in the streets.
Yeah.
Just
I was petrified.
Yeah. Were you in a private house then?
Yeah, and she had one son. And I always remember he only got so much, you know, breakfast and so forth. And I remember the boy saying to his mother, she's eaten all the marmalade.
Do you remember where you actually worked here?
In the mansion, yeah. In the mansion, turn right, I think.
What was your day-to-day job like?
Well,
is it boring?
It was boring, but he just carried on. But the thing is, he never made any friends. He couldn't really talk to anybody, you know. He used to have people come in, and all he'd get was the first name. And, you know, he just didn't have any friendship or anything like that.
So were you in the digs on your own as well?
Yeah.
I think with a lot of veterans, it helps if they were either in a camp, a group of them, or if there was a couple of them, say, in digs together.
No, I was in by myself, yeah. Now, as I say, it was boring. I just used to go to bed and wait for the next time when I had to come back.
Sure. And also, you were so far away from home as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. And you couldn't say where you were. You weren't allowed. In fact, I was just telling them, it's not so long ago since they put, you know, this on television, is it really? I mean, it's only a few years back. Yeah. And my niece were watching it coming on television. And I said to her, I worked there. Did you, Auntie? Nobody knew. And my mother and father never knew anything. No, nobody told me.
The problem, isn't it? You couldn't tell anyone and you didn't.
No.
So did you partake in any of the activities that were
not here? Not really, no, because, as I say, you had to rely on the soldier coming to pick you up to take you to the digs. So all I used to do was lay on the bed and read and, you know, there was no television or anything, but and just read and wait for the next day coming.
And listen to Whitmer. The actual work itself.
Yeah.
Did it give you any idea that you were doing something with code breaking, or did you realise quite early on?
I didn't realise what I was doing because nobody told anything. All I was told was to type these letters. You know, it came through on the machine. That was all I knew. Didn't know anything else.
So, when you were demob,
yeah,
and then you spent 30 years not talking about it,
yeah.
Do you remember in the 70s when the story first started coming out?
I don't.
No.
No.
When did you start talking about it to your family?
I can't remember, but I know as soon as it came out on news, on the television.
Probably was in the 70s.
It must have been in the 70s, yeah.
Now, today, you're not here on your own, are you?
No.
Who have you got with you?
I've got my two grandchildren and my daughter's partner and grandchild's boyfriend.
What's your name?
Nicole.
I've cheated and asked this question already before we started recording. How proud are you of your granny?
Extremely, very proud.
Have you always known this secret?
No. I'm only...
No.
Once you started coming here, I don't think I really...
No, you didn't. No.
No. Only a few years ago.
So do you tell all your friends your granny was a spy?
Yeah.
Has it made you want to know more about what they did?
And... Yeah. Like, she didn't really know what kind of went on here. So it's quite cool to have someone close to you that you can come here with. And you can say, oh, well, my nan worked here. And they're like, whoa.
And she did her bit to help the country when it was in its darkest hour.
That's right.
You know, it is 80 years ago today that, you know, that war started.
Yeah.
And all of you, from the most genius code breaker down to the humble tea girl, you know, every single person who worked here had their part to play.
Yeah. Yeah.
And do you look back, are you proud what you did?
I am, really, yes. I suppose I am, yeah.
You should be.
Yeah.
Audrey, can I just say thank you very much?
You're welcome.
And can I say thank you for your service?
You're very welcome. Been a pleasure.
Derek Dodd. I was an intercept operator in the Y Group.
Did you get drafted or did you join up?
I joined up because I was just become 18 and that was a thing to do at that time. When you were 18, you were either called up into the mines.
But you did it to avoid the mines.
Yes, I went and volunteered for the army. My choice was the Royal Artillery because that was my father had been in the Royal Artillery, you see. But they weren't recruiting for the RA and for the Royal Artillery at that time. So I said, well, what else is there? And they said, Royal Corps of Signals. You'd be a wireless operator. So I hadn't a clue. I mean, I was never a Boy Scout and I had no idea what it meant. And I got the usual 6 weeks training up in Ossett in Yorkshire. And someone then came along and said, you're in the Royal Signals, you're going to stay in the Royal Signals and you will eventually be a wireless operator, but we've got to train you. So they sent me with another crowd and we were in an old converted mill.
Wow.
And We were there for about 4 weeks. I swept floors from morning till night, never touched a radio, anything to do with radio at all. And then one day, an officer came from London, and apparently they were looking for people who were interested in a special job in the Royal Signals. And I thought, well, this is better than sweeping the floor all the time.
Yeah.
So I volunteered. And the next thing I knew, I was sent to the Isle of Man, all places, to train. And there I learned, I became a special wireless operator, and I trained there on the Isle of Man from March in 1943 until October.
Was there, like, army barracks on Isle of Man?
No, we stayed in the hotels on the front at Douglas.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
You got to stay in a hotel?
Yes. Well, we had one lot of hotels, and the next lot of hotels for us were Italian prisoners of war.
Oh. So did you have to share a room, or was it single room?
They were barracks, as far as we were concerned. Okay. It was the army you were in. You didn't get single rooms in these. But we spent 7 hours every day learning the Morse code right the way through, including the Japanese Morse codes. But mainly they were concerned with the operating systems rather than the Morse itself. So long as we learned the Morse thoroughly until we just thought Morse.
Yeah.
It was that kind of training. It was thorough all the time.
So it's like learning a new language.
Yes,
and hearing it all
that's
the time.
Right, yes. When you heard it, you automatically wrote down X or whatever it was. At the end of that time, we had to pass examinations for speed, that we could do certain speeds. And then I was sent to join a unit which was being formed, of all places, in Hampstead, in London. 7th Section of Special Wireless, it was called. And again, there we weren't training so much as learning the procedures of the various countries that we were to intercept. German wireless radio operations procedure, Italian, and our own, and American and Russian as well. Just learned the various procedures of the way they sent so that you could recognise them when you heard them. That was the whole point.
Right. So again, like another language you're recognising. Because I've heard some people say that they even spoke to each other by saying, did it da da da?
Yeah. Oh, yes, you could. Yeah. Yes, you could quite easily.
Yeah.
I mean, I could go right through the Morse alphabet now.
Wow.
It's drummed into you at that time. I still have it. I wouldn't be able to write it as quickly as I used to be able to, but I still know the whole code, A, B, right the way through to Z. So from there, we became an operational unit. We were no longer training. And eventually, we were sent to Bishop's Waltham, just outside Portsmouth. And that was in March of 1944. And of course, as you know, D-Day. So we were then set up as a proper unit. We were under canvas in a field and didn't have set rooms. I can only describe them as single-decker buses with radio sets inside them.
Right.
Instead of seats, you had a radio set and a table. And I think there were 6 in each of these. That was our operating methods, where we operated from.
Was it a shift pattern?
So
rotate. What was that like? 2 people took over the same position every 12 hours or every 10 hours?
They've been like sort of 8-hour shifts.
8-hour shifts.
8-hour shifts. Midnight till 8 in the morning, 8 till 12. But you just got used to the shift. It just became second nature to you after a while. So that's how we carried on until D-Day. And then, of all things, I was on duty at midnight on D-Day. The interesting thing was that we knew nothing about what was happening, except that all the fields around us, it was all countryside, all the fields around us between Winchester and Portsmouth were filled with American soldiers under canvas. And suddenly, one day, they all disappeared. Went out one morning and all the fields were empty. Just the canvas tents, the men had gone. And that, of course, was just a couple of days before D-Day. And when they went down to Portsmouth and all the other places to get the boats. And we carried on doing our normal intercepting, listening to the stations and taking all the usual things. And that night, it so happened I was on the midnight shift. And before we went on, we had an intelligence officer who used to come on shift with everyone each time, you see, to give you some idea of what you've got to listen to and so on. I can't remember his actual words, but he said something like, it's a special night. Didn't say what it was. It's a special night tonight. You might hear some peculiar things. Don't miss anything. That was the sort of instruction that we got. That was for the shift.
Wow.
And then, of course, we heard the planes going over us because we were... So it's only just outside Portsmouth.
Yeah.
And the planes were going over us. We could hear that going on. So we knew that there was something big. And then because it started and the radio suddenly started saying all sorts of things. And, of course, the German operators, radio operators, were very, very good. They were first class as far as security was concerned. So you know, if you found something different, you wonder what it was and made a note of it. And that night, you've got all sorts of things happening. Messages from frequencies you'd never even heard of and all sorts of things. So it was obviously there was a big thing going on. And next morning, of course, we were told. But it was quite an experience that night.
Were you just taking down the messages or were there ones that sort of made you look at each other? Or you know?
No, because you didn't know. I mean, they were all in code. Everything normally came in five-letter code. That's the Enigma message that came over.
So you just passed that on?
That's right. We would just copy it all down as we heard it, whatever it was, in these five-letter groups. Every so often it was collected up by the chief watch operator at the time. He would collect all those. That was it as far as we were concerned. Just listen for the next lot.
So the only way that you could tell that anything different was happening was the frequency of the messages?
Yeah, that's right. Except that you suddenly found that you were getting messages in German, which they never, ever did. That was breaking their security. They never used plain language messages. And suddenly you were getting the odd one coming over, which is what they obviously wanted us to catch. That's why they said, don't miss anything.
So the Germans were basically slipping up because they were being put under pressure.
Yes, that's what it was.
That's incredible.
I wasn't a German speaker, but I'd had 5 years learning it at school. So I knew enough to recognise it when it came in as... Rather as being the normal code, I could recognise German words in it. But after D-Day, when it got back to fighting normally again, because the armies were moving forward and backwards all over the place.
Yeah.
So their radio stations obviously were doing the same thing. And we had direction finding equipment where we would listen to a signal, turn a dial until we got the right measurement of it and record that. And other stations would do the same thing at the same time and we'd get a triangulation of where the station it was. That's how they found out where the radio stations were.
So you're pinpointing their locations?
Yes, that was part of the job. That was another section of the Y group. The idea was that you should get it so close that so you could even pit it not only to a town but to a field pretty well.
Wow.
On the other side of the continent. And then when the war ended... They didn't need us doing this anymore. But, of course, the war was still on in Japan.
Yeah.
So I was sent to join a unit that was being formed to go out to the Far East, down at Baldock in Hertfordshire. So went down there. We started covering the Japanese shipping and so on until the bomb dropped. And that closed us down because that was the job finished, so I thought. Instead of which I was sent back to Harrogate, which was the headquarters of us. And at that time, the whole thing was trying to become mechanical and it was high-speed Morse. You couldn't write and copy it down as we had been doing all the time. It was all sent automatically on tape. So I had to sort of understand how to take the tape and read what was on there. He spent the whole of his shift trying to work out on a bit of tape what the message was.
So was it coming through really fast?
Yes, the message was coming through, I mean, there were 300 words a minute being sent. It was sent on tape, but it was still the same Morse code they used. It came out on the tape, not as a dot and dash, but as gaps. We translated the gap into an A or a B or a C.
Oh, my God, making my head spin.
Did that until the war finished.
So as we look back 80 years now from the invasion of Poland, how do you feel about that time?
Well, I can't remember. I was only 18 years of age. Like any other 18-year-old, I was more interested in football and cricket than war.
And did you get to play any of those?
Oh, yes, yes. Played a bit of football and a lot of cricket. I liked cricket. Played that up to quite a... an old age, really, for a cricketer, I suppose. I must have been 60 before I finished playing cricket.
So how did you feel when the book about Bletchley Park came out in 74?
It was very strange because I knew nothing about Bletchley Park. I mean, as far as we were concerned, it began and ended at a radio set. We took the message and it was gone and that was it. And we just waited on the frequency that we'd been given. We would wait until the next one came along and did the same thing. All we knew was we had dispatch riders, as you see them over there. We had the dispatch riders, we had two of them. And each day they used to get on their bikes, sail off with all our messages to some place called Bletchley. I had no idea where it was. It could have been north of Scotland, as far as I was concerned, anyway. And that was all we knew about Bletchley. But never inquired either. We weren't interested, we were only interested in our own little life at that time. That was all.
So the codes that you wrote down and then were taken off, it wasn't like that was something that you had to force yourself to keep a secret?
No, I mean, all I can remember is that when I went to the Isle of Man to join this particular Y group, as it turned out to be, I was asked to sign a bit of paper, which I said, because you were a soldier, you did what you were told.
Yeah.
So I signed a bit of paper. That happened to be the Official Secrets Act, but I didn't know that at the time. But it never really occurred to us to inquire.
I suppose what I mean is, did you understand enough of what you were doing for it to make sense to have kept it a secret?
Well, I never thought about it as keeping a secret.
No.
It just, you don't talk about it. As it happened, my wife was also doing the same job. You know, we could talk to each other about it.
Oh, right.
So, but nobody else ever asked me about it.
No.
No.
When was the first time you were asked about it?
I think when it first started appearing. Until my wife died, we hadn't missed any of the reunions. We'd been there to all of them, and since then, this is the first one to be back again.
You missed 2 years because...
I missed 2 years, yes.
2 years ago, Mum was too old to travel, so we couldn't come. And then you missed last year because it was Michael's christening.
That's right.
So this year we all came with him for moral support.
Yes, there's not many of us missing. The beach at Morpeth.
Oh. This is a special story. I've told this story before, though. I still like to hear it. After D-Day, when the troops started moving, 7th Section closed down, and we all went into different parts of the organisation. And I was sent up to Northumberland to set up a radio station at Belford, not far from Newcastle, right opposite Holy Island. In fact, where my radio set was, I could look out and see Holy Island. But... there would be four wireless operators doing the shifts. So we had a 24-hour shift coverage all the time, and a driver and a corporal as a senior to look after all the admin. That was the setup. And we were billeted with a local farm, and they gave us one of their barns to live in. But we had set up the radio station, which was a van on wheels. And then we'd have the radio set inside it, and a thing called a goniometer, which was what you measured the readings with, you see. You had that in this wagon, and then you had to drive around 360 degrees all the way around it, sending a signal so that you could, what they call, calibrate the set, so that you could see which was 304 degrees so-and-so or 250 degrees somewhere else. But the problem was, where we were on the field was right by the sea. So we had to go down onto the beach with our radio truck to get right the way round. We got onto the beach and whizzed up and down on there sending our radio signal. And eventually the van got stuck in the sand and we had to leave it overnight with the tide coming in. You see. We went back next day and dug it out, got the van out and got everything back onto the land again. And that evening we were in a local pub. And there was another unit, a Royal Artillery unit, who weren't far away, said to me, just checking, I said, well, we'd be down on the beach today. I said, oh, where? Whereabouts have you been on the beach? We told them where we were, just along what we were doing. Oh, that's funny. We're there clearing the beach of landmines, and we haven't done that bit yet. And we'd be chatting up and down in the truck. So that was another bit of fun. That was army life. You know?
Born to survive.
So, yes.
Oh. Well, thank you ever so much for talking to me today. It's been lovely to talk to you. And I'd like to take this opportunity to say thank you very much for your service.
This is London. You will now hear a statement by the Prime Minister.
I am speaking to you from the Cabinet Room at 10 Downing Street. This morning, the British ambassador in Berlin handed the German government a final note stating that unless we heard from them by 11 o'clock, that they were prepared at once to withdraw their troops from Poland, a state of war would exist between us. I have to tell you now that no such undertaking has been received, and that consequently this country is at war with Germany.
It's just the thought of you, the very thought of you, my love.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.